Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to spend the first half of this talking about this UFO cult called the Raelians. John Moorhead joins us as our guest. You can join us as well with questions or comments. The Raelians have certainly been in the news. About 3 weeks ago was the last big hurrah for the Raelians, claiming, of course, in January it was, they claimed that they had cloned the first human baby. Then they said they cloned a second. They're still being rather circumspect about the actual location and identity of these babies, if indeed they exist. Those who had reason not to doubt are now beginning to have reasons to doubt the claim. But that's not all there is to the Raelians, and there's much more to be known. We're going to try and find out in this half hour of Issues Etc. who they are, who is Rael, and what it is they teach, and why are they, at least claiming to be, cloning human babies. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. John Moorhead is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. and Associate Director of the California Office of Watchman Fellowship. John, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's start with Rael himself, the leader, or at least the supposed leader of the Raelians. Tell us about him.
Well, he's an interesting character. His real name is Claude Vorilhon, and he is a French journalist and a former race car driver. And he claims that in December of 1973, he was driving around a volcanic mountain range in France, and he saw what looked like a UFO or an extraterrestrial spacecraft descending. Claims that he got out of his car and felt drawn to the object and went over and met an extraterrestrial being. Who claimed that this being was calling Claude Vorilhon, whom he renamed Rael, to reveal the true origins of humanity, where allegedly human beings were created themselves by a cloning process many years ago through a race of extraterrestrial beings. And he has become the founder of one of the largest UFO religious groups called the International Raelian Movement, and they claim about 40,000 members distributed through 84 countries around the world.
And who were, at least according to Rael, who were these aliens who contacted him and revealed these things to him?
Well, he claims that some 40,000 years ago, an advanced race of extraterrestrial beings called the Elohim, which of course may sound familiar to our listeners, it's the Hebrew word, one of the Hebrew words for God in the Old Testament. They claim that the Elohim, these extraterrestrial beings, are the true creators of humanity. That many, many years ago, these extraterrestrials came and through a process of genetic manipulation and cloning, they created the human race. So they reject the concept of evolution, but in their version of creation, it was a creation through extraterrestrial cloning.
So the aliens came, according to their claim, the aliens came to Earth, seeded the Earth with the proper genetic material or with human beings themselves, and that accounts for our origins here.
That's correct. They're claiming that the genetic material itself is the product of the creation of the Elohim, and that they created our first parents, and they have created other races throughout the universe as well.
Does Rael or his followers, do they call for worship of the Elohim space aliens, or is it simply just a fact that they seeded us here?
It's just a fact of seeding. This group is interesting in that they almost hold to a form of religious materialism. That is, they don't hold to, and as far as I've been able to tell in their literature, any concept of a supreme being they're calling to worship. It's almost a form of materialism where the supernatural and the spiritual is downplayed in favor of the material. And what they're really doing is creating a religion or spirituality that takes biotechnology, interest in extraterrestrials, and these types of things, and combines it with a very hedonistic and materialistic kind of spirituality.
Do they claim that through our subsequent cloning of ourselves, something akin to eternal life can be achieved?
They do. For them, eternal life is through this cloning process. Some of the listeners of this program may recall a science fiction film from a few years ago called The Sixth Day, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, where in that fictional scenario produced by Hollywood, once you were deceased, they could simply retrieve your genetic material, clone you, transfer your memories into your clone, and that would provide a means for you to live perpetually. Well, what Hollywood envisions as science fiction, the International Raelian Movement conceives of as reality. They believe that their group will possess the ability in the near future to retrieve your memories while you're living And then as you age or if you die accidentally or what have you, they can clone your body through a speeded up maturation process of a clone body, transfer your memories into the clone, and that survival of various clones through time, in their thinking, provides the means for eternal life.
And is Ra'el beyond just the first contactee of the Elohim space aliens, does he have any special role among the Ra'elians?
He does have a special role. He's something of a messianic figure. He's the leader of the group. They don't worship him, but it was through his alleged experiences with the extraterrestrials. He claims he was not only visited once, but twice, taken aboard the spacecraft, taken to the planet of the Elohim, where he saw many different things. They revealed to him information about our true origins as they understand it. And in that sense, he has provided for them a sense of revelation of our origins as the extraterrestrials have revealed it. And he is regarded as the leader of the group internationally.
And so is he the revelator of this particular movement? In other words, is he the source of their revealed truth?
He would be the revelator, but not in the sense that Christians would view biblical revelation. Ra'el doesn't claim to have any kind of supernatural sense whereby a supreme being is revealing information. His claim is that, again, the Elohim have revealed to him over a period of time the true history of the origins of humanity, which he claims is reflected somewhat in the Bible. He claims that the word Elohim, translated God or gods, depending upon the context, in our Old Testament refers to those who came from the sky. So what's interesting about the International Ra'elian Movement is through Ra'el's revelations, if you will, what you have is a common theme of UFOs, extraterrestrial visitation, the implantation, if you will, of the genetic material between extraterrestrials and humans, the mythology of the Erich von Däniken and Chariots of the Gods types of thing. All of that has been combined together and combined with a current interest in biotechnology to arrive at a unique religious system for our time.
Tell us about UFO land.
UFO land is an interesting creation, one of many creations of the International Ra'elian Movement. It's something of a cross between a theme park and simply a means to disseminate their particular views about the origins of humanity. If you go to UFO land, you will find a replica, supposedly a life-size replica of the spacecraft that Ra'el claims that he was taken aboard. You will find a giant reconstruction of a DNA chain, the spiral strand of the DNA, which is a very important symbol in their mythology. So UFO land is a place where people can learn about the worldview and the spirituality of the Ra'elians.
And what about Clonade?
Clonade is a company that one of many companies that was created by the Ra'elians. It was originally located in the United States, but with the legal controversies over human cloning in this country, it has been relocated several times. The Food and Drug Administration found one of the other locations in the Bahamas, but that has since been relocated once again. It's a company that exists somewhere in the world where this organization, I believe, has the finances, the biotechnology, and the scientists working on the problem of human cloning that one day, if they can overcome the hurdles involved technologically in human cloning, they may one day be able to pull this off.
And is there reason to take Clonade as a research and facility, wherever it may be? Is there a reason to take it seriously, or is it just kind of a trumped-up claim that they are researching human cloning and even more recently that they've actually achieved it?
Well, I think we need to take it seriously on the one hand and yet with a healthy dose of skepticism on the other. I do believe that they have the finances necessary to support this work. There was a family, a very wealthy family, who lost a child and was interested in the cloning process for their child. They contributed large sums of money into the Clonade process. They have the funds. They have the scientists with the expertise working on this problem. They apparently have the lab equipment necessary to bring it about. But if you do any study into the cloning process in biotechnology, you'll discover very quickly that it's not an easy process. It's one thing to clone a sheep. It's another thing to clone a human being. And we've learned just recently through the news that the first cloned sheep, Dolly, has recently died. Apparently there were genetic problems. She aged at twice her normal rate. So there are serious problems with animal cloning. Human cloning is even more difficult. So we need to take them seriously in that they have the ability and the interest in doing the cloning, but in terms of the technological obstacles they must overcome, I think we ought to be very skeptical about whether or not they have successfully cloned a human being.
So since they've been in the news because of the cloning issue, some have overlooked kind of the ongoing nature of the Raelian movement. You've mentioned several times that they have kind of a laissez-faire hedonism with regard, we're not talking about any ethical system here. In fact, it seems they question most ethical systems.
That's correct. In some sense, they're almost a counterculture spirituality. For example, they have a practice called sensual meditation, where their group members will come together, and it's a form of meditation that where you are to open yourself ethically and sexually to other individuals. They tend to frown upon marriage and children, traditional institutions within many cultures. They support a form of free-flowing sexuality between peoples of all races and genders and sexual orientation. So they really are an organization which is reacting in many ways against, for example, a Judeo-Christian ethical system, and that's expressed primarily in this form of sexual expression within the group.
Let's deal, if we could, John, with kind of a scriptural and Christian response to the Raelians. Let's start where we just left off, to their hedonistic ethic.
Well, I think we need to recognize as Christians, looking at it from a biblical perspective, that the God of the Old and New Testaments wants his creatures to experience pleasure. He's created us as human beings that can experience pleasure, but there are certain contexts in which we are to experience that pleasure. God has established from the creation that men and women are to come together in a single monogamous heterosexual relationship for a lifetime and experience sexual pleasure as well as procreation within that context. So we certainly want to, as Christians, acknowledge that we are to have pleasure as human beings, including sexually, but there is a context that God has given where that is appropriate. Outside of that, it's inappropriate from a perspective of biblical ethics.
To their view of the origins of human life and the creators of human life, what's the biblical response?
Well, biblically, of course, the word Elohim, as it refers to the God of the Bible, refers to the one true God who is the creator and sustainer of not only the universe and earth itself, but life on the earth. That in the beginning God spoke and brought the creation into existence, and that God created the first man and the first woman, and that all human beings are the natural descendants of that first created pair. So biblically speaking, there's no room within our worldview, accepting biblical revelation, for the idea of extraterrestrial creators.
Their naturalistic worldview, kind of their mechanistic or materialistic view of human nature, the Scripture's response to this?
The Scripture's response is that if you say that they're on the horns of a dilemma here, if you say that extraterrestrials have created humanity, then the question is, who created the extraterrestrials? It's impossible to stop at a natural cause for the universe and for life, because the question is, where did that come from? From a Christian perspective, we say that God created, that God is the uncaused cause of everything else that exists. We don't need to look for an explanation for God's existence, because he has the answers for his own existence within his own nature. God spoke and the universe came into existence, and therefore God is the first cause and the ultimate cause of everything else that exists.
And if a human being is merely a sum of material parts that can be cloned, and all you really have to do is find a way of transferring memories to the next generation of your genetic material, it would strike me that there is very little room there for a view of a spirit, of an immaterial part beyond memories to the human being.
That's correct. For the Raelians, even I believe the memories themselves that are supposedly transferred, even that can be explained as a result of a natural process. What makes us human beings and those memories are nothing more than biochemical, electrical responses that are then taken and transferred from one biochemical body into another. There's no room in the Raelian theology for an immaterial spirit or soul or anything like that. They really are religious materialists. And, of course, that, again, would contradict biblical revelation. In biblical revelation, the Bible tells us that, yes, we do have a physical nature, we have a material aspect, but there's also an immaterial nature, whether you want to call it spirit or soul or mind, and that spirit survives the death of the body in fellowship with God if you're a believer, and separated from God if you're an unbeliever, awaiting resurrection of the body at the end of the ages. So the doctrine of the understanding of anthropology, or who human beings are, is very different from the Raelians and in historic Christianity.
And you pointed out here that their ethics, we're really talking about a rather logically consistent system within the Raelian. It's not logical, but it's within its own internal consistency is pretty well intact. I mean, if I'm simply a material being, there's no accountability to anything divine, to a first cause, to a supreme being, then hedonism really is the way to go. Personal pleasure and fulfillment really is the way to go.
Well, that's correct. This group, like a lot of the new religious movements, is internally consistent. If you accept many of their presuppositions within the system, it makes sense to those who are on the inside. However, as those of us who are outside of it looking at it, we see serious problems with it. The idea of first cause, the idea of the immateriality of the human spirit of human nature. There are serious areas where we can critique the worldview of the Raelians, and we can come alongside them. And increasing numbers of people drawn to UFO theology, and we can intelligently articulate the good news of Jesus Christ.
But you know, in a way, I mean, I'm trying to look at it from the as objectively as I possibly can without chuckling. There is a certain elegance to the Raelian view. I mean, the only question they really have found necessary to answer is, where did we come from? Once they have that answered in the Elohim space aliens, and they don't push that any farther, then this really is kind of a, it seems to me, a religion that would appeal especially to the mindset of modern people.
I think you're correct. I think they have all of the elements necessary for an increasingly appealing spirituality, if you will, a religious system that doesn't bring the negative connotations of Judeo-Christianity with its ethical system and the demands to recognize humanity as fallen and in need of a savior. They have a system that explains the origin of humanity. It taps into the increasing numbers of people who are interested in the UFO phenomenon and view that as extraterrestrial visitation. It has a sexuality, an emphasis upon sexuality and hedonism and materialism. So I think that it provides a powerful draw for increasing numbers of people.
Does that also mean it presents a different kind of challenge? It being a non-theistic, being a materialistic kind of a religion, does it present a different kind of challenge to Christianity apologetically than do what we're used to dealing with, which was essentially theistic and religions that have a transcendent element to them?
Yes, I believe it does bring unique challenges. I think one of the greatest challenges for us as evangelicals is to not give in to that tendency to look at their doctrine, their theology, and look at the way they dress, for example, and to engage in laughter or to belittle that or to marginalize it. I think we need to take this group very seriously. It's attracted an enormous number of followers around the world and finances. This has impacted the lives of men and women who are desperately searching for some form of meaning and an explanation as to why they're here and their place in the universe. And they're doing it within a framework, a non-theistic framework, a framework of religious materialism that draws upon UFO mythology. And I think that presents a tremendous challenge to the church to create a new apologetic and evangelistic strategy that can intelligently communicate the gospel to its membership.
Do they have in view an end game, an eschatology of sorts? Where do they say this is all going?
I have not been able to find in their literature any end times, if you will, or eschatological outcome. For them, it seems to be an emphasis upon the continual and perpetual enjoyment of human pleasure through this cloning process as a means to eternal life, with no specifically stated outcome at the end for all of this.
Do they believe the Elohim aliens are returning?
That is the hope. They are trying to raise the funds and get permission from the government of Israel to build a headquarters, if you will, an embassy. They believe that will demonstrate to the extraterrestrials, to the Elohim, that humanity is serious about making contact. Once that embassy is built in Israel, the Raelians believe that the Elohim will return. And in this sense, this is where they have some form of eschatology. They will return, give us the fullness of the information, the extraterrestrial information and biotechnology and all the scientific advancements, and turn this planet once again into the technological utopia that it was under the original influence of the Elohim.
You know, it strikes me, you mentioned The Sixth Day, which was the Schwarzenegger film that talked about cloning, but there was another film that was out several years ago starring Jodie Foster called Contact, and it was actually based upon a novel written by the late...
Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan,
yes, of course, and put forth by his wife, which seems to, well, basically has exactly this kind of plot line.
Yes, you'll see that in Contact. I think you'll also see it in some sense in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the Steven Spielberg film from many years ago. It's fascinating if you watch the development in films over time that deal with extraterrestrial themes. You'll see, of course, the 1950s as we are wrestling with the Cold War. We were really viewing it, viewing any possible extraterrestrials through the lens of communism. As time has progressed, as we deal with the UFO phenomenon on a spiritual level, you see a transition in films to where we project our salvation coming from the stars. You'll see that in Hollywood, and now you see it in many UFO religious groups as well.
Is there a rise of UFO cults? I think about Scientology, which isn't often thought of as a UFO cult, but the science fiction writings of L. Ron Hubbard are very clear about what he thinks the origins of life and of the human race are.
That's correct. J. Gordon Melton, in his Encyclopedia of American Religions, would classify UFO groups and Scientology as a part of the same spiritual family, if you will. So there are some similar elements there. I don't know if UFO groups per se are on the rise. I do know that increasing numbers of individuals are intrigued by the UFO phenomenon, and they are viewing the UFO phenomenon in light of spirituality and importing some of these ideas into their religious expression. So in that sense, it is certainly having more and more influence.
And I certainly am hearing, at least from the mainstream of the UFO community, an increasing tone of an increasing religious element to the stories of contact, to the stories of abduction. The aliens seem to be talking about a future for the human race that has transcended religious overtones.
Yes, there's a long association in the occultic lore and material coming from a spirituality known as theosophy. There's a long history in this country of spirituality that has looked to ascended spiritual masters, extraterrestrials who come and visit, who came from long ago during biblical times, and who interacted with humanity. These ancient ideas are becoming more and more popular in contemporary circles.
John Moorhead, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you so much.
John Moorhead is Associate Director of the California Office of Watchmen Fellowship. We've been talking about this UFO cult called the Raelians. When we come back from this break, Wesley Smith joins us. A couple things to talk about with Wesley. Newly returned from Europe, he does want to spend a few minutes talking about the communication gap between what he calls Eurotalk and Ameritalk. But before that, a more pressing issue. A new report on assisted suicide out of Oregon. This is something that we have been tracking for years now with Wesley. We'll get his take on this. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide when we come back. And then in the third hour, a reminder, if you have not been following our month-long series with Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. This is the segment you'll want to hear in the third hour, Alternatives to Church Growth, in the third hour of Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Everyone agrees that it is a good thing for the church to grow. But how does the church grow? What does Scripture teach about the growth of the church? What makes it happen, and what kind of growth is good? Hi, I'm Todd Wilkin. For answers to these questions, I'm recommending the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. You can also order the book online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find a direct link to Concordia Publishing House. Order the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The controversy over the Miguel Estrada judicial nomination has Senator Chuck Schumer caught in a bind. The liberal senator says he can't vote for conservative Estrada until he sees internal Justice Department memos written by him. But now the New York State Conservative Party is asking Schumer to turn over his memos. David Brody reports from Washington.
Because of the memo issue, Schumer and a bunch of liberal Democrats are holding up Estrada's confirmation vote by filibustering on the Senate floor. Mike Long with the New York Conservative Party says if he wants it that way, turnabout is fair play.
He has decided to stonewall and play every tactic possible to try to prevent this nomination from happening. So I believe what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Long has written a letter to Schumer asking to see memos he's written concerning Estrada. Long is convinced it will not paint a pretty picture.
Well, I think it would show that there is a clear coordination of various groups that the senator is working with to try to block this nomination.
Long isn't the only New Yorker who has complaints about Schumer. That list is long. Former New York Congressman Herman Badillo has come out in support of Estrada. He tells me that Schumer has been a complete disappointment, especially considering Estrada is from New York.
He comes from New York, where Senator Schumer lives, and his mother voted for Senator Schumer. We want Senator Schumer to know that our community, who supported him strongly when he ran, is not going to support him next year.
We put in calls to Senator Schumer's office, but we received no response. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The Justice Department has refused to release Estrada's memos, saying it would violate attorney-client privilege. For Family News in Focus,
are you looking for a part-time job this summer? Don't miss the next St. Louis Zoo Job Fair held from 10 to 2 in the Living World on March 1st. Energetic, responsible, and service-oriented people are needed for part-time positions, including engineers and conductors for the Zoo Line Railroad, face painters, balloon vendors, catering and food service personnel, groundskeepers, gardeners, gift shop attendants, parking lot attendants, and more. For more information, visit or call the St. Louis Zoo.
Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Find out with the new book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Welcome back. Coming off that conversation with John Moorhead on the Raelians, I want to remind you, you can read John Moorhead's overview of the Raelians on the internet at watchman.org/CA. He's from the California office, so simply put California's CA at the end of their website. That's Watchman, watchman.org/CA. You can read all about the Raelians, according to John Moorhead, there. For the last half of this hour, we're talking with Wesley Smith. There's a new report on assisted suicide in Oregon. The claim has always been that the numbers are low, that relatively few people will be seeking this. Have the numbers been rising? We will find out during this half hour of Issues Etc. with Wesley Smith. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll also spend a few minutes talking with Wesley about his trip to Europe and what he discovered and what he's concluded, and a guest comment that he's written for National Review Online to that effect. Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of the book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, you spent some time in Europe, and you have written in National Review on the communication gap. What did you discover there?
Well, it was very interesting, and this piece is a little outside of my usual jurisdiction. As you know, I tend to write about bioethics, assisted suicide, against animal rights, and so forth. But what I discovered in Europe was, I think, what is going on in the United Nations between France and the United States. Which is, a completely different perception of what the purpose of law is, and particularly, I think, what the purpose of the Resolution 1441 is. Let me explain what happened. I was invited to a Fulbright Commission event in Lisbon, Portugal, and I was asked to come and present a paper against the legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide. I was very honored to be asked, and so I went there. And while in Europe, and part of the thing is cultural exchange, right? You know, I met a lot of Europeans, pro-euthanasia people. There were people there who were, you know, on both sides of the cloning issue and abortion issue and so forth. And in that, in the experience of what occurred to me, what I discovered was how differently what I say the United States looks at what dialogue is and what old Europe views the dialogue as being. I think what is going on is the United States, our culture and our approach, is interested in results. For us, process and dialogue are about achieving a desired end. For Europe, process is the desired end. And therein lies the huge difference between how we're viewing 1441 and how the French and other old Europeans are.
What do you mean by that, process is the end?
The Europeans, it seems to me, value consensus. And what happened to me is a microcosm of what I think is going on a far more fundamental and far more important arena in this current crisis over Iraq. And let me tell my story, because I think it'll help explain, because it's on a more human level, what is going on. I presented a case against euthanasia that I think is quite compelling. And among the points I made was that in the Netherlands, where euthanasia has been permitted since 1973 and which was formally legalized last year, Dutch doctors kill at least 1,000 people a year who've not asked to be killed. That's against every bit of law that is contained in the Netherlands, the so-called protective guidelines, which require repeated requests before euthanasia can be done legally. But even though year after year after year, now we're talking thousands and thousands of people who under Dutch law have been murdered, realize that if you kill somebody who has not asked to be killed in the Netherlands, it's murder in terms of a doctor doing it for reasons of ending suffering. It's murder under the law. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Dutch patients have been murdered by doctors, sick patients, disabled patients, who have not asked to have euthanasia. Of these, very, very, very few are ever prosecuted. Of the very few who are prosecuted, most are found not guilty. And of the infinitesimal number, like five or six, who have ever been found guilty, none of them, not one, faced any punishment for murder, not even a professional discipline from the Dutch Medical Association or an attack on their license. That was my point, one of the points I made. I was up against a Dutch ethicist who was in favor of euthanasia. Now, when I make that point to American pro-euthanasia folk, they either accuse me of exaggerating, which I'm not, or they say, well, it's okay because these people were really sick anyway. And I point out, well, that's not what the guidelines say. The guidelines say you have to ask for it. And therefore, guidelines don't protect against abuse. They merely give an appearance of control. That's their purpose. But the Dutch fellow looked at me very calmly and said, well, yes, as if it were unremarkable that Dutch doctors were killing thousands of people, murdering thousands of people. And then he said, and this is almost a direct quote, it is good to have these laws to tell doctors what is proper practice, but of course they should not be enforced. Well, my jaw dropped. What's the point of having laws if you're not going to enforce them? Then take that experience, and now we're fast-forwarding to the goodbye dinner, and a person came over to me who had been another presenter, not this Dutch fellow, and he said, you don't believe in dialogue. And I said, what makes you think I don't believe in dialogue? I've flown here 6,000 miles. I've sat down next to people with whom I profoundly disagree. I was civil. I did not name call. I was not ad hominem. I was friendly when we weren't on stage. I was friendly to the people. I presented a strong case, and I backed it up by evidence. How is that not dialoguing? He said, you're not interested in dialogue. You only care about what you believe. And I didn't understand that, because it seems to me that the point of dialogue is to present perspectives. And I said, well, no. I presented my perspective. The Dutch fellow presented his perspective. It's up to the audience to decide with whom they agree or disagree. But it occurred to me, he wasn't upset with my opinions against euthanasia. He was upset about my approach, because I took an unequivocal position that I'm not willing to compromise on. And so what he was actually doing, Todd, was calling me a unilateralist.
I've heard that a lot lately.
That's what I figured out. And so it suddenly all this stuff came clear to me. What is going on? You take a look at what the Dutch don't want to punish the doctors, right? I figured out finally what's been going on in the Netherlands with euthanasia is you had people in for it and people against it. So what they decided to do, and what's going on in old Europe, is you try to accommodate all sides. That means, yes, we're going to permit euthanasia, but we're going to try to put some reasonable limits on it. The issue isn't to enforce those limits. The issue is to give respect, or let the people who oppose euthanasia think that their voice has been heard, so that they will acquiesce to the consensus. And so it doesn't matter to the Dutch that the laws aren't enforced. What matters is that the people who oppose euthanasia and the people who support euthanasia have been accommodated, and the consequence is thousands of murders.
So in other words, the laws limiting the practice of euthanasia among the Dutch are in place because the Dutch want to throw a bone to those who oppose euthanasia. They're not really interested in enforcing those laws. This is simply about keeping everyone
happy and satisfied and quiescent. What they don't want is conflict based on principle and conflict based on ideology, because in their view, I believe, this is supposition, but in their view, all of that has led to all the wars that the Europeans have suffered over the last several hundred years. So now they're just not going to believe in anything. And the reason this really came home to me was that a pro-abortion woman from the Netherlands told somebody at the conference that she has no moral principles, which I believe. But the reason she said that was she was asked, well, you know, to be able to explain and justify her position, and she was incapable of doing it from a moral position or a principled position because that's not how she thinks. The idea, it seems, is not to have principles. You do your thing, I do my thing, and we have these general consensus. You act within the consensus, and everybody's happy, because it doesn't matter what you think as long as you stay within the consensus.
So this explains a lot about the apparent complete disconnect and as you say, communication gap between the United States, the United Nations, and old Europe.
Right. So what occurred to me from, and I've had some comments on this today from people who are in Europe, and they're saying it's spot on, that what they care about, they don't care what people believe. What they care about is the process. And so that if, you know, that's why it's constant talk, 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 and coming up with things that, if you can come up with something that everybody agrees on, let's say, in fact, one of the people who was a UN representative made a presentation saying we should only outlaw reproductive cloning because everybody agrees on that, but not everybody agrees on therapeutic cloning or research cloning, therefore we don't have consensus there, so we should act on the consensus on reproductive cloning. And it didn't matter to him whether it was right or wrong to engage in cloning. What mattered to this UN representative was that we had a consensus for one aspect of this problem. So it's not a principled argument. It's one based on, can't we all just get along? And I think that can work in things that don't involve important moral principles. I think it can work on trade policy. I think it can work on perhaps on taxation or something. But when you're talking about killing or not killing, when you're talking about creating human life for the purpose of destroying it, as in cloning, or not doing so, or treating human life as a commodity, I don't see how you, at least in American talk, how you justify just going along with the lowest common denominator, because that's what consensus ends up being. If we all only act within the consensus, that means the person with the lowest common denominator prevails, because we will never be able to get past that person. So what you're seeing going on in the United Nations now is President Bush went to the UN looking for international support for the dealing with Iraq. He got Resolution 1441, which says that unless Iraq proactively disarms, serious consequences will follow, which is a euphemism for war. Now, to Americans, we look at the letter of 1441. It says Saddam must do A, B, and C. If he doesn't, the consequences will be D, E, and F. And George Bush is now saying, well, okay, he has not done A, B, and C. It's time to get on with D, E, and F. But the French don't look at it that way. For the French, it seems to me, and for other old Europeans, 1441 was not about the content of the resolution itself. It was about creating a consensus. That is, they weren't upset about Saddam at all before Bush went to the United Nations. Then when the United States wanted to make a major thing out of this, they decided to accommodate us by getting those inspectors in there, right? But they don't want to go to war because there's no consensus for it. So to the French and others, we're acting unilaterally because we want to enforce the letter of the law. What they say is, no, we can't move until everybody agrees. So to them, and they're furious with Bush because to them it's worse to be a person who is willing, a country willing to act outside of the general consensus, than it is to be a tyrannical dictator who kills his own people and has weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Wesley, I certainly hope that your article in National Review gets a wide reading, because I think you're right. The feedback you're getting, you are spot on when it comes to that assessment. Let's talk about the report that's come out of Oregon regarding assisted suicide. Where do the numbers stand now?
Well, actually, the new the full numbers will not come out until March from the official Oregon report. What you saw was an article which got planted by a pro-assisted suicide group called Compassion in Dying, which helps facilitate a majority of the assisted suicides that are done in Oregon, which said that the number of people they've handled the last year doubled over the year before.
And do you have reason to believe their statistics?
Well, yeah, because they're the ones really running the whole program.
So give
see,
us...
See, most doctors in Oregon are refusing to participate in assisted suicide. And so what's happening is that if someone's own doctor won't do it, you can go doctor shopping. We've talked about this before. You don't have to have a long-term relationship in Oregon with the doctor who writes the lethal prescription. So what they do if their own doctor refuses is they'll go to a Hemlock Society or a Compassion in Dying. They've got a list of doctors who are willing to lethally prescribe. Those doctors will then check out to see whether they believe the patient is terminally ill, and they'll write the prescription, even though they barely know the patient. And so what you have is many, if not most, of these assisted suicides occurring are being done as a result of these euthanasia fanatic groups providing the doctors to do the rubber stamp prescribing. Since most Oregon doctors don't want to get involved with this, there was even, and you'll recall I wrote an article about this, Kaiser Permanente Northwest in Oregon put out a memo to its doctors, which a copy was leaked to me, in which they asked Kaiser doctors who would be willing to assist the suicides of Kaiser members who were not their patients, because so many Kaiser doctors were refusing to participate. So the Kaiser Permanente, the HMO, was looking for doctors willing to write lethal prescriptions for patients who weren't even their own patients.
Now, what are the numbers coming out of this this group Compassion in Dying? What are they claiming by way of the number of people and the rise in the number of people that have committed assisted suicide?
They said for the people that they helped, it went up from in 2002 that they called them clients. Compassion in Dying's clients, 30 used Dr. prescribed drugs to hasten their deaths, up from 17 a year earlier.
And generally speaking, where do you think the numbers across the state stand?
Well, it's hard to know. I think there will be an increase, and I think there will. The more people become comfortable with killing as an answer, as we've seen in the Netherlands, the broader the practice becomes. There will be an increase, but realize that these statistics are meaningless, because the only way that Oregon gets a statistic about whether or not an assisted suicide has occurred is if the prescribing doctor fills in the paperwork. And it's pretty clear that the only way a doctor is going to fill in the paperwork is if the doctor thinks they followed the guidelines. So everything is dependent on what I call the death doctors. So the only information we have come from death doctors, and then the sometimes family members will be contacted by the Oregon Health Department, but only those family members that the prescribing doctors, the death doctors, suggest that the Oregon Health Department contact. And to show you how we really don't know what's happening, because it's all done in deep, dark secret, the doctors who say no to assisted suicide, which happens in many, many cases, because some of these people are going to two or three doctors before they find one willing to prescribe, the doctors who say no are never contacted by the Oregon Health Department. I submit the reason those doctors who say no are not contacted is the Oregon Health Department doesn't want to know what it doesn't want to know. What if a doctor says no to assisted suicide because the patient isn't terminally ill? We'll never know it because certainly the prescribing doctor won't admit that they've filed a prescription for somebody who wasn't terminally ill, right? So the whole thing, this whole idea of these reports is a fraud. We're only being told what the prescribing doctors want us to know.
So in other words, you are inviting perhaps a bit of speculation that in Oregon, at the very least, there are doctors who are writing these prescriptions, not reporting them.
I'm saying it's possible. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's happening or not. In fact, if you take a look at the Oregon Health Department, they say they have no way of knowing. How do you prove a negative? What I am saying is that the numbers we have, the reasons why these people wanted to commit assisted suicide and so forth, the only source of information, the most of the source of information are the prescribing doctors, many of whom don't know their patients very well, with a few interviews with family members, but only those family members that the prescribing doctors point out to the Oregon Health Department, and that doctors who say no to assisted suicide are not contacted to find out why, which would really give us, I think, a better balanced understanding of what's going on here. I mean, the whole point, the pro-euthanasia people say, well, Oregon is a test tube so we can see what really is happening, but it's all being done behind closed doors, strict confidentiality and secrecy, and all the information coming from one side of the debate.
What do you make of the claim from Compassion and Dying, this group that has leaked the figures, and others that say that the end-of-life care for the genuinely terminal in Oregon and across the country has improved because of Oregon's unique laws are driving those improvements? In other words, the fact that people now have the option for a physician-assisted suicide has actually made palliative care better nationwide.
No, I don't agree. First off, the move to improve palliative care started long before the modern assisted suicide movement got going. It started with Dame Cicely Saunders, who started the modern hospice movement. Her first hospice was in 1967. She started in-home hospice care in 69 in London and imported it or exported it from her perspective to the United States, to New Haven, Connecticut in 1972, from whence it spread across the country. My dad died in hospice in 1984 before anybody had ever heard of Jack Kevorkian. Secondly, I think that assisted suicide, rather than adding to palliative care, has detracted from it in this sense, that at one point, remember, we used to talk a lot about hospice? Now, because the media gets so caught up in whether killing should be permitted, a lot of the oxygen gets sucked out of that discussion, and we talk about Jack Kevorkian, or we talk about Oregon and assisted suicide. And so it strikes me that people are less informed about the palliative potential than they were previously. Finally, Oregon always did pretty well with use of morphine per capita. The states that have really gone up are those which have passed laws saying that aggressive palliation is a legitimate medical purpose, and doctors will not be punished if they aggressively treat pain if the patient accidentally dies. Rhode Island outlawed assisted suicide while passing a law that said what I just described, and use of morphine shot through the roof. So it isn't assisted suicide that is making a difference. It's getting the doctors to understand that they will not be attacked by drug enforcers if they aggressively treat pain.
So make the case for us, since I agree, a lot of the wind has been taken out of the what we should be talking about, hospice and other palliative care.
For example, look at this show. We spent 15 minutes talking about assisted suicide, and I'm not criticizing at all.
Sure.
because this is out there, it's the 800-pound gorilla. And poor hospice, gentle hospice, you know, gets a little bit of discussion, but often in shows it gets no discussion.
So make the case for us with about 2 minutes before we have to go, Wesley, and that is someone would say it's either assisted suicide or this painful, long, dwindling death with the loss of dignity.
It's utter baloney. Dignity is something that we have to care about, and that means loving the person who's dying, loving the person who's disabled, letting them know they're not a burden, making sure they know they're still an us and not a them, that they're as valued as they always were, that we don't want them to die early, that we want them to be comfortable. The increases and the breakthroughs in pain control have been breathtaking in recent years. They just came up with a gene. They found a gene that explains why some people feel pain more severely than other people. Hospice is a viable alternative, in-home care for people who are dying. You don't need assisted suicide not to die in agony. And part of the problem is people, the argument that you just described, it's either or, has led people to become so scared that they might support euthanasia. In fact, you don't need to kill people to control their suffering and alleviate their suffering. Moreover, as for example, in England, only two patients out of 1,800 AIDS patients in St. Christopher's Hospice asked for assisted suicide. Why? Because they were cared for properly. If you care for people properly, in most cases, the desire to commit suicide goes away. And in those few cases that it doesn't, what we need to do is make sure that people get attention, they get antidepressants, and so forth. Now, not everybody will ever change their minds. Always, I mean, you're never going to get 100% change of minds, but we have to care for people and not kill them, Todd.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much. Keep up the good work. Next time we talk to you, I want to talk about the Arizona State Legislature. They're considering their own assisted suicide bill as well. Thanks
very well.
Again.
Thank you.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of the book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. By the way, you can read Wesley Smith's columns, the one we mentioned before as well, called Communication Gap, Eurotalk versus Ameritalk, at his website. Wesley Smith's website is wesleyjsmith.com. That's wesleyjsmith.com. I think you can also read it at National Review Online. That's NRO.com. NRO.com. When we come back from this break, the last in our this month series on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.